91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. This hour, we hear the surprising story which led a North Miami Beach delinquent gang leader to leave a life of violence, crime, and drugs. Good afternoon, it's Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. Drug dealing and mail fraud were but two of his crimes. But inside him breathed an idealistic kid who dreamt of being an attorney. Against slim odds, he made it. Dropout David Lee Windicher now practices law in Florida and Georgia legally. He heads a nonprofit organization which gets high-risk kids literacy, a GED, and a foundation for a new life. He's amazed himself from dope dealing to reading books. Meet attorney David Lee Windicher next, after the news.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents, Monday edition. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. For the next hour, we visit with the remarkable David Lee Windicher, now Windicher Esquire. Earning that sobriquet was quite a long shot. His North Miami Beach gang merely called him Red. And later, David Windicher of the Hood was arrested at age 11, and then 12 more times.
He fought, he dealt drugs, carried out mail robbery. He's now an attorney. He helps similar teens to read and gain a GED. He's an author as well. We'll talk about his book, The Amer-ICAN Dream, His Story in the Making.
It's quite a title.
Yes. And I just want to say it's a coming-of-age story of perseverance and survival in the face of abject adversity and poverty. And it's a story of redemption and salvation, and it's a story of hope. Welcome to you, David Windicher.
Joseph, Bonnie, thank you so much for having me on the air with you guys today. I'm grateful for the opportunity because I know that this airing will happen in the jurisdiction where the 95% of the chapters in my book took place.
Right, which came, you know, that wasn't going to be my first question, but, well.
It was interesting to read about all the locales.
Yes, it was. I didn't know a lot of the places, but you know what, David? It really surprised me because I was unaware of these gangs. It's 5 miles from where I live. The crime rings, the drug rings. How can that be that we don't know this is happening?
North Miami Beach.
Yeah.
Well, it's just kind of like you see in the movies. The railroads literally will separate two type of communities, lower socioeconomic environments and affluent environments. And technically, affluents don't have reasons to go to lower socioeconomic environments. So we tend to not look that way. We just disregard it and we go on about our business.
Mm. Well, give us the street boundaries, kind of where your hood was in North Miami Beach.
In North Miami Beach, North Miami Beach Senior High School area is John F. Kennedy Middle School. Mm-hmm. Then the Star Creek Complex where we were running the drugs from was on Northwest 191st, is Northwest 3rd Avenue. And then you have Carroll City. All these areas, Miami-Dade was a wide area. We didn't have just North Miami Beach. North Miami Beach was where a majority of us lived, but we had, you know, connections in Carroll City, Liberty City, North Miami, pretty much anywhere in Miami-Dade County.
David, as I was reading the book, I found myself wondering so many times, how did he do this and how did he survive and what gave him the strength to persevere? So that's really my question. Why didn't you give up and what kept you going and how did you survive?
Well, my family was my catalyst and everything that I went through was a challenge on my faith. I needed to believe that there was a greater purpose for my life than selling drugs, living on the streets. What happened was I wanted to elevate my family's name. I didn't want to continue down that path because I knew it was either going to be 6 feet in a pine box and or jail bars. And I was done with all those things. I've experienced them. I made plenty of money on the streets. I wanted to find a legitimate way to do things. And I wanted to believe that I needed to have faith that there was a greater purpose for my life.
We talked about you being arrested at age 11 over some bicycle
Pegs.
But you were different from the start, also a red-haired Brazilian youngster, I suppose, with your last name of German descent.
Right. I was actually Argentinian.
I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm. No, it's fine. We're just two different languages there, Portuguese versus the Hispanics.
Right.
I stole those pegs because I felt that I should be able to afford a set of $20 pegs so my brother and I can tow each other to a local park, Grand Olds Park, to play football. We couldn't tow each other because we had one bike, and it was around football season. I think it was January 20th, 1990 exactly. And, it was NFL playoffs, so everybody was excited about the playoffs. There was a huge pickup game at Grand Olds Park, and we needed to make it there on time, and we couldn't because we only had one bike. And sharing was never an issue in our household because my parents taught us right. I mean, I just didn't make a good decision. I thought that I should be able to own a pair of $20 pegs so I can tell my brother. And I went and I stole a set of pegs and I got caught.
But there was a transformational moment for you, because until that time you were a good boy, albeit impoverished, but you were a good son, you were a good brother, you loved your brother Christian. But somehow you said, I deserve this and I'm gonna take them. What was that? Do you have any idea now?
Well, it was poverty. I didn't know how to deal with it. I didn't understand how to improve the situation that when Friday came along, the fridge was empty. I didn't understand poverty. I just couldn't wrap my mind around it. And so I didn't know how else to do anything except just take it. Take what I thought was rightfully mine, because I couldn't get it otherwise. I couldn't get a job. My parents couldn't afford it. And so I made a poor decision. And that the issue of poverty and not understanding how to wrap my mind around it sent me off into the darkest years of my life.
You and your family lived also in California and Argentina. Quickly explain how you became to living into Miami.
My father first started off in California, and when I was a little kid, he used to do independent contracting for a company that he would paint industrial machinery for. He worked for about 6 months painting these machines, and he was supposed to get paid, but they kept promising they'll pay him. They wouldn't. And so eventually he filed suit. He won at the trial level, and he was awarded damages and a good amount of money, whatever they owed him. And then what ended up happening was the private company that was employing him appealed the decision, hired an attorney, and at the appellate level, my father lost. The only thing he had left was enough to take us back to Argentina, where he knew he can protect us and take care of us. So we left. And that's what I remember from the judicial system, that it planted the first seeds of bitterness in my heart, because it told my dad that justice was denied him, not because he was wrong, but because he was foreign and because he was poor and he couldn't get a counsel appointed to him like in criminal cases. So we ended up going to Argentina, and, poverty was another thing in Argentina. There's dirt roads, there's no cars, people are asking for food in the streets. It was tough in the late 80s in Argentina, but my father believed in America. He didn't want to give up on his dream, so he stacked up some cash and he moved us. And this time we went east, we went to Miami.
So here we are with the bike pegs. What happened? The consequences? You got caught.
Yes. It was embarrassing. My parents weren't expecting this, and then I ended up getting put on community control for a while. It just made poverty worse for us because there was a cost to it. There was a court cost. I had to go before a judge every single month, and then I had to do a bunch of community service hours. So I became the bad kid in the neighborhood. I was a kid arrested at 11, so I was already anointed the bad kid. And that's exactly what happened with kids. If you tell them that they're brilliant, they're going to show you that. They're going to show you that they're the best kid that they can possibly be. But if you tell them that they're a bad kid and they need to be in court and they got to do community service hours and they can't hang out with other kids, they're going to repeat that. That's going to be their reputation.
What kind of community service does 11 or 12 year old kid do?
Yeah,
I had to go clean up Olita Park. That's what I did.
And so then I think what the guy called you, what you write in the book, is he called you a little crook.
That's right.
And so then you said, yep, you became a really good little crook. So when did you join the gang, and what gang is it, and does it still exist?
The gang doesn't exist anymore. It's a criminal street gang. When you talk about gangs, there's different ways to look at it. There's criminal street gangs, which are cliques of people that come together to serve a common goal or a need that they have amongst each other in the community. And that's what we were. And then you have nationwide gangs, the Bloods, the Crips, Tres Puntos, MS-DOS, those type of gangs that are just been historically together. We were a gang that came together. We called ourselves Star Creek, and it was about 10 to 12 of us, and it rotated. A lot of different people came in and out. But we came together around the age of 14, 15. I saw my first murder around 13 at Sky Lake Mall movie theaters. And ever since then, I was thinking, you know what? If I don't have some protection around me, I could end up with a bullet in me, because I was already fighting a lot. At the age of 13, walking home from school, I was in tons of fights. I mean, every single Friday, it was a fight. I knew it. My dad luckily was a boxer growing up in Argentina. So he taught me how to fight, and I was able to defend myself. But it got to the point where when these kids picked up that I could fight, they would send 9, 10 kids after me, and they would leave me bloodied.
Yeah, and was that because there was gang stuff going on, or was they didn't like you, or because you're red hair, or what was it?
Well, I am Hispanic by blood, but I'm of Caucasian descent. I have fair skin and red hair, and I think that that's what started the Zopound gangs, and JFK would follow me home, and they would, you know, take whatever I had on me. I would have to fight for my stuff. And after a little while, I didn't have a choice. I just had to do whatever I had to do to protect myself. It wasn't because of my skin color. I guess it was because of my skin color, because there was this thing called Cracker Day in JFK. And so every Friday, the black kids would come after the white kids on Cracker Day, and they would try to beat you up. And so it was a real thing, and I just had to experience it every single Friday.
You mentioned that poverty promotes the gangs, but also, reading your book, I was kind of surprised how addictive being in the gang was for you.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, once you start developing some momentum in providing for yourself and being able to say, I know where the next meal is coming from. If I want an outfit, I can go and buy it. Those things are hard to let go of, because now you've never had anything, and all of a sudden you have. You felt oppressed by poverty all your life, and then when you can have means to an end for something that you need, why would you stop? It's the worst type of addiction. It just sucks you in and you cannot get out. And then you try to find ways to make more money, just like a career. You try to climb the rungs of a ladder in a career. Same thing with being in a gang and generating income through illegal activity. You want to find ways to make more money.
We're speaking with David Lee Windicher. He's a criminal defense attorney. He's licensed to practice in both Georgia and Florida. And he is currently, I think you're currently the managing partner at Windicher Law Firm, correct?
That is correct.
Okay. We're going to take a short break on today's Topical Currents, and we'll be right back with David. Stay with us.
Past 1 o'clock. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman is today's Topical Currents. Our guest is David Windicher. He's joining us from WABE in Atlanta. We're talking about his book, The American Dream, his story in the making. And we're learning how David Lee came from being a North Miami gang member to an attorney who practices law in both Georgia and Florida, and who was particularly eager to practice law in Florida and went through a lot to get to it.
A lot, and we're going to get to that. And not only that, was sworn in where he had been formerly
in an orange jumpsuit.
Yeah, right. Oh, but let's talk to David since he's right here. Okay. I just want to, give our listeners an idea. If you could give us a snapshot of ages 16 to 19, there was the jumping into your gang, the crimes, the arrests, the drugs, the dealing, the 24/7 drug, drive-through almost operation with the pot. Fortunately, you stayed away from cocaine, correct?
Yes, that's right. We were smart enough to know that the statute for cocaine would keep us in prison for a long time, so we didn't want to run those kind of risks. And on top of that, the type of people who would be purchasing cocaine were not the type of people that we wanted coming through our drive-thru. It was, in fact, a drive-thru.
Okay, so give us a little snapshot of those years. Kind of what it was like.
It was just like any, I compare it to a career, because being on the streets and being a gang member and selling dope and doing illegal things to make money helped me build a reputation. And the stronger my reputation, the more I can grow. And so we went everything from stealing cars and sending them to chop shops and doing credit card, fraud on checks, or fighting to protect our territory, or, you know, selling drugs. We became very well known for our dope hole that's what we called it, the dope hole. We became very known for it. And it gave me an addiction. It was the key to overcoming poverty. I started feeling during those years that poverty was the biggest challenge that America faced, and I noticed that the gap between the rich and the poor was astounding to me. So the solution was clear: make money however I could to get away from poverty, and that's what I was doing. I became very dangerous in the way I was thinking, and I started acting recklessly. I didn't want to not take risks, because I felt like I had nothing to lose but an opportunity to gain. So I did whatever I could to enhance my reputation, just like anybody would try to enhance their reputation in a career.
And, you know, talk about your relationship with law enforcement during that time.
It was really rough. I mean, these guys, I was arrested 12 times within a 25-mile radius. That is not a coincidence. I carried guns because I was scared of officers. A lot of the things that you see nowadays with the smart technologies are being captured, and the Michael Browns, the Eric Garners, the Walter Scotts, Freddie Grays, and the Khalif Browders of the world, we know about their story because someone had an iPhone and captured it on some media. Back then, it was happening all the time. I can't tell you how many times I was walking down the street, profiled, pulled up by a cop, guns drawn, handcuffed, drug money taken from me, dope taken from me, no arrest. See you later, kid. Or had my butt whipped by him.
Tell us about your arrest at the apex of the William Lehman Causeway.
Oh, that was an interesting one. That one, I get pulled over under the suspicion of DUI, and the officer says to me, you know, hey, your eyes are bloodshot red and your breath smells like alcohol, and I need you to step out of the car. And now, mind you, I'm atop the William Lehman Causeway. So he wants me to do field sobriety examinations way up there. Winds gusting, ships are passing by, cars are whizzing by. No one in their right mind should ever consent to that there, because
you
can't pass it. I was completely sober. As a matter of fact, I told the officer I was just coming from my girlfriend's house and I'm just trying to go home. I did not drink any alcohol, et cetera, et cetera. He said, no, you're under arrest for suspicion of DUI. So they take me back to the station, and there they do a breathalyzer. The breathalyzer comes in 0.000, and I lost my mind in there. And I said, see, you guys are just as corrupt as the crooks that you guys are arresting, because you guys are putting me in jail for no reason. I told you I didn't have any alcohol. The guy said, my breath smelled like alcohol. My eyes are bloodshot red. Where is the alcohol? It's 0.00. Bring that officer to me now. And they had to like restrain me. Then they sent a little pretty officer in there, a female cop, and she's like, look, let's just straighten this out. We need you to urinate in this cup, and if you didn't get arrested, we'll clear up everything. I mean, if you didn't have any alcohol in your system, we'll clear everything up. And, you know, sure enough, the urine sample provided marijuana. I used to smoke marijuana. I didn't smoke marijuana that night because I was with my girlfriend and we were hanging out. She was going through a tough time. And they charged me with DWI. So I was driving while intoxicated from marijuana I had in my system from several days back, because this officer wanted to say that my breath smelled like alcohol, and that was enough to take me in.
So just skipping ahead for a second with the law enforcement troubles and what we are hearing about, what are you trying to do about that right now?
Well, what I'm doing is trying to help kids that are similarly situated as I was. There has to be compassion for others. Those of us who have been there need to go back and help the next ones up. That's the way I look at it. So I started a nonprofit organization. It's called Red Ink. Red was my nickname growing up, and Red Ink is the DBA for Rehabilitation Enables Dreams. And the reason I'm doing that is because you have to be able to understand someone to reach them. You cannot reach them unless you are able to understand them or try to understand them. And because I know what they're going through, I know that education is the most important thing that they can have. If they have an education, it'll empower them, it'll increase our communities, it'll help. You know, the higher literacy amongst lower socioeconomic communities will minimize recidivism, and that's what I'm doing. I'm working with a lot of people on that, and that's just me giving back because I have a duty. It's my job to go back. I may have a career now, but my next step is now to make the world a better place. I can't let having a career and making some money change me. I made it, but I'll never forget where I came from, and so I have to help these kids get to where I'm at.
It wasn't easy getting into law school. It wasn't easy getting into college to begin with even, but to get to law school and then also to pass the bar examination in two states is pretty amazing. Tell us a little bit of the fortitude that it took to accomplish those things.
A lot of things happened along the way that helped motivate me. I saw my best friend, Joey Torres, get incarcerated for 15 years. And that kind of really woke me up that it could happen to me too. And I just wanted to push and I wanted to do whatever I can not to quit. I wanted to see how far I could take my life and elevate my family's name. My parents worked too hard to get us here. And it was my duty to help them allow myself to become the best version of myself. So I never quit. I just, no matter what the obstacle, the adversity, I just kept showing up and I kept fighting and I kept doing whatever I could to make sure I could take the next step because I knew I wanted to be an attorney and nothing was going to stop me. There was nothing that was going to stop me. With the bachelor's degree, I felt so out of place. I felt like I still was speaking in Ebonics. I had to learn how to conduct myself and dress better. And I needed to understand how to acclimate myself going from selling dope to reading books. So that wasn't easy, but I did it. I finished at the top of my class because I would not quit. I would just not quit. And then with law school, it was extremely difficult. I mean, it was almost impossible because I went through the law school admissions council process and I did a fee waiver because of my financial situation. So they allowed me to register or apply to multiple schools, all of which denied me except Georgia State and John Marshall showed some interest. And so I went to go visit them face to face. I wanted them to look me in the eye and know that when they saw me, they saw someone who was not a victim of circumstance, who learned from his situation and who was ready to do whatever it took to take advantage of the opportunities that people would give them. And I did that with law school. It was extremely difficult, but John Marshall gave me a chance to get in. And I started doing things that would give me practical experience because I knew I needed to, A, get practical experience to be able to pass the bar, and B, I needed to show that I can volunteer for different things so that they can see that I was of the character to be able to practice law. Then the whole process with the Florida bar, I mean, that was a chapter in and of itself because of what they made me go through.
We're going to get to that, but I just to go back for 1 second before, was it Nicole in your life and your friend Joey Torres going to jail? What else was it that caused this turning in your life, this new direction, that you were going to do this no matter what?
My faith. I didn't believe in God for a very long time because I thought that if you are a believer of God, then why would God put you as one of his children in this situation to be oppressed and feel this poverty that's crushing and crippling so badly? So I resorted to believe that I needed to remove all of the doubt from my body that God wasn't real, and I did, and my faith just developed momentum, and I started reading scriptures and parable by parable. I realized I had a purpose that he preordained for me.
If you would, before we take a break, David, would you read from page 180 in your book? Do you have it with you?
I do. Okay. It says, I do not regret joining a gang. I do not regret quitting a gang. I made plenty of poor decisions in my life. I do not regret any of them. I risked my life in ways no one ever should and for reasons that made no sense. But by the fall of 2001, my new challenge was to see how far I could take my life. If I was going to continue to take risks, they would be to reach a purpose. I wanted to live life of substance. I wanted to lead a life worth remembering. I knew that in any breakthrough, the first guy through the wall usually comes out bloody. But it would be worth it. I was willing to risk it all for a real chance at a real life. I would accomplish my goals and fulfill my promise to my parents, or I would literally go down fighting. I memorized the words that Acosta said to me that night in front of my parents' house. Those words resonated so deeply that I cannot hope to properly explain what they meant to me, but here's my attempt. I needed to be told that I couldn't do it. I needed to hear my own fears and self-doubts come out of the mouth of a kid who was just like me. Acosta's words gave me courage, momentum, and the determination to change the hood's perception of itself. The hood was a self-imposed cycle, a self-fulfilling prophecy. We believed that we couldn't obtain, and worse, didn't deserve the American dream, and so we crippled ourselves. We acted out against the stigma in most destructive ways possible. We adopted a "the world screwed me over, so screw the world" mentality and lived accordingly. The thing about sticking it to society is that when we were the only ones who were hurt by our hatred and anger. Nothing we did proved anything other than that society was right.
Very, very profound. David, tell us a little bit about how it isn't so easy to get out of this gang and the hell that you and your father and your family had to go through to get out.
Sure. Once people found out that I didn't want to contribute in that sense anymore, I knew there was going to be some retribution, and immediately out of the gates there were fights in front of my house. I probably was in more fights after I decided to stay away from the streets than before. My dad and I, my brother, fought so many times in front of my house. There's a story in there where it says about what happened to my dad. I mean, we had seven or eight people show up in a car, and it was just three of us, and we fought and fought, and we ended up winning the fight, but we suffered some injuries. My dad got hit with a rock in his head, and he was bloodied everywhere, and at that point, I was at my darkest point because I didn't know if I was going to be able to survive it. Looking over my shoulder every minute is what it felt like I needed to do when I decided to kind of, so to speak, turn my back on the streets.
In that part that you read, there are two important messages. One, taking complete responsibility for all your choices and actions, and the other, that you have no regrets about the choices you made because they made you the man you are today. Could you just talk a little more about that for us, and what was going through you at the time you wrote that?
I remember the resiliency that I was instilled with going through those things, getting up every day and not knowing if, you know, you're going to be a victim of police abuse or get shot or having to get the money you needed to get to take care of whatever you needed to take care of. It just helped me become a very strong-minded individual. There was nothing that could stop me from pursuing the things that I wanted to accomplish. And that's kind of what I developed going through the streets. So that's what I was thinking. And a lot of the things that helped me get through those things was thinking about how there was no hope for us because everybody that was coming out of the streets either wants to be a rapper or a professional athlete. And in my mind, I felt like we don't need any more rappers or professional athletes coming out of the hood. We need thinkers, doctors, lawyers, judges, scientists, engineers, teachers, people who care and can come back and make things better. I'm not saying athletes don't come back and make things better, but we need community leaders. And that's what I wanted to become. I wanted to always get out so I can come back and give back.
Now that you're a criminal defense attorney, I'm sure you've been in the situation where you have a youngster in front of you that you're defending who has no idea that the guy in that neat suit and tie had such a background. Do you tell them about that?
I tell all of my clients my story because I want them to understand that I can relate to them on a foundational level. I was saying earlier how you can't really reach people if you don't understand them. And I want people that I represent that are going through similar things to know that I'm not just after it for the money. I know what they're going through, and I'm not trying to get them through the case and fix the case and then see you later, call me when you get another case. I'm trying to do whatever I can to teach them not to make the same mistakes that I made. And I'm trying to spark their minds by sharing my story with them. And you would be surprised at how many people just are in awe when they hear my story, because you know, by looking at me, you wouldn't be able to tell.
No, not at all. I want you to take on the the Florida bar story now. You were already licensed. You got your, you passed the bar in Georgia. You had to convince them that you were okay to sit for the bar because of your criminal record. Then then you decided you wanted to go back and do, be able to practice in Florida.
The one thing that stands out most to me about that whole process is whatever happened to United States Constitution's full faith and credit clause. I mean, I was practicing for a year. I was found fit in Georgia. And I mean, these people made me go through so much administrative red tape. I mean, I went through the entire role, really. There were so many things. At one point, they asked me to provide notices of appearance for court dates on all of my cases. Now, mind you, I have 13 arrests, okay? Who keeps a portfolio of all of their court, clerk of court arrests, days of court? Who keeps those? No one keeps a record of all of their notices to appear. And so I thought that they were trying to do whatever they can to break me because they were just asking one thing after the other. It took literally from November of 2012 to March of 2014 to finish the process. A year and a half of my life invested into going back and forth. And it got to the point where around October of 2013, I said, you know what, listen, how about we just meet eye to eye? Because I want you guys who are judging me to look me in my eye and understand and hear with your own ears my story, because there is no way that I can keep submitting. It got really costly. I mean, it was one thing after the next, and it was always some kind of reason why my application was going to become stale, and I had to stop working and send a bunch of documents. And then we ended up doing an investigative hearing before the Board of Examiners. We ended up, Michelle Gavagni was there. She was the director. And then there was three other people who basically interrogated me for almost 3 hours.
Why were you so motivated to get that Florida bar accreditation? And also, what does it mean for you to be on this program in your locale? A lot of people are probably listening that know you.
Well, the reason why Florida meant so much to me is because it brings my rehabilitation full circle. I can show that no matter how rough my start was, I finished strong. And I didn't want people to condemn me for the short time in which I was doing illegal things. I wanted to show the world and people who grew up like me that even if you start out bad, you can change the perception of who you are, and you can bring more good about with your life. And that was the whole thing. Like, my entire life was not, at some point during the process, I realized that the journey wasn't about me. It was about the people who needed my story. And for those people is the one that I was fighting for. The red ink clients, the people who I'm sponsoring their GEDs, those folks are the ones who I wanted to fight for, because I saw a bigger picture. And the bigger picture was that I needed to fight so that others can believe that the American dream was there for them to take.
We have an emailer, and we haven't given out the emailer phone. We will. But it's from Leah, and she says, I recently met David at a training required for lawyers newly admitted to the Florida bar. If only all lawyers understood the importance of addressing poverty.
Yes, I met Leah at the University of Florida State when we did a CLE there together. We were talking, and she works at University of Miami, a really nice girl. We just got to talking about things, and she's got some great plans, and it's true. We talked about that, about poverty. It's just really sad that it's a solution that that it's available. I mean, the problem with poverty is that all it takes is money. When there's a national disaster or international catastrophe, I mean, we're throwing money left and right at it. But when something is happening here in our communities, we're really not focusing on them. I can tell you, I dropped out of school because not just poverty, but because the school system was so bad. The compulsory school system here was so bad. I mean, I was doing the same math in 10th grade in America that I was doing in 5th grade in Argentina. I wasn't motivated. If they would have had more resources, more better books, I don't know what they could do to really improve the system. I'd have to really start thinking about that. But I can just tell you this much. it's not just poverty from in people's homes. It's the school systems in lower socioeconomic environments. Poverty just affects everything so bad. And the money is available because obviously we invested in different things. We just are not putting it back in our own communities.
David, also relate the story about your tenure with the Miami Dolphins. Not as a player, of course.
Right. I will only wish. But that was an interesting situation. When I was in undergrad, I always wanted to work, as I was saying earlier, people growing up in the hood always want to either be a football player or a rapper or something. I wanted to work in the NFL because it was just bigger than life to me. And they denied me an internship. So as soon as I graduated, I put together an email, a fax, a voicemail that I prepared, and a letter that I handwrote and mailed. I did that for 3 weeks, and I would send it to Liza Fandino, the human resource coordinator. And she finally called me back and said, Dave, you are killing the rainforest, my man. Just cut it out and just bring yourself in here. We'll interview you. So I interviewed with her, and then she brought me into a second interview. It was a panel interview. They hired me, and I immediately wanted to make a splash. You know, I was a go-getter in the streets. I'm going to be a go-getter in my career. And so I was thinking social media. MySpace was huge. And if you go on there now, you can still see the MySpace page I created for them. It's myspace.com/finsticks. What I did with the finsticks thing, everybody here in South Florida knows 888-FINSTICKS is their phone number.
Right.
And so what I did was I called AT&T and I got 877-FINSTICKS registered, and I had it routed to my cell phone, and I put it on the MySpace page. So people were calling me for season tickets all the time, and what I would do is I would do the transaction. People would call me at the office to verify it was official. I would run the transaction, and I would go to the ticket sales board, and I would write the number of sales. And they're like, well, how are you getting these sales? And so one day somebody called and ordered a package of 50 season tickets. And they lost their mind. So they were like, oh my God, this is crazy. How is this happening? And so they brought me into a meeting of the minds with Harvey Green. And it was interesting because no one was very receptive to what I had to say about how to use social media and those things associated with social media to make money for the Miami Dolphins. So they gave me some autonomy, but I got blackballed by everybody else. And then when I started gaining some more momentum, I told them, they came to me and they said, hey, you are a loyal employee. You need to give us this number, et cetera, because you can't. It's a conflict of interest for you to have. And I said, look, I came in here with good intentions. I want to make sure I do whatever I can to promote the team. And now you guys are telling me, like, making me feel bad about it. So how about this? If you want the number, I want $50,000 for it. And they said, kid, you're out of your mind. And so I thought they mishandled the situation, so I resigned. And what I did was I called the ticket broker who ended up buying the large package and offered him the number. He actually bought the number for me. But at first I called the Dolphins and I was like, hey, listen, I have someone interested in this number. You guys should really think about getting this number. And if you call the number now, it goes to premierseats.com, where Rob Breeze owns that number, and he's using it to get ticket sales for his private ticket clinic, which is fantastic for him and terrible for the Dolphins. I don't understand why they would not reward the small guy on the low guy on the totem pole trying to help the team.
David Windetcher, before we break, I just have a little question to ask you that I didn't understand reading your book. We haven't touched on how, as your marijuana dealing grew, you were running cars from Miami to New York with the dope and bringing the money back, of course. And you chose to do it in this gangster mobile with the big rims and that. Why didn't you guys rent a car? Because you got pulled over. Why didn't you rent a car or something?
I mean, the problem is growing up in the streets that way is that you'll know immediately which lessons I learned and what areas I lacked in. Because, you know, while I was a hustler and I was doing things to make money, I still was thinking like a hood kid. I wasn't looking at the whole picture, even though we were strategic and we were making money and all that. Mm-hmm. That was just dumb of us, and that was a terrible mistake. I don't know what else. I guess I wanted to be profiled. I have no idea.
We're speaking with David Windetcher. He's an attorney practicing in both Florida and Georgia, or he can practice in both Florida and Georgia. And we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to focus really on what David's doing today, and we'll be joined by the DeKalb County Solicitor General, and that's DeKalb County in Georgia, when we come back. So stay with us.
And it's today's topical currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, 47 minutes past 1 o'clock. We return with David Windicher. We're talking about his book, The American Dream, History in the Making. And he's joining us from Atlanta station WABE.
And joining us now from DeKalb County, from their Solicitor General's office in Decatur, Georgia, is DeKalb County Solicitor General Sherry Boston. Welcome to you, Ms. Boston.
Thank you so much, Bonnie, for having me on the program.
It's great to have you. Would you first explain what your relationship is? You're kind of on opposite sides from David, is that right?
Well, yes. David actually is a defense lawyer, but we often partner with people that are just genuinely interested in giving back to the community. And David can do that in a myriad of ways, and we were happy to partner with him because we thought he had a lot to offer, which he does.
So tell us what you're doing about the diversion program. Is that what it's called?
We have a program called GOALS, which stands for Gaining Opportunities and Living Smarter. And it's a program I started when I came into office in 2011. And it is a program that is geared towards young people that do generally have some criminal history, but we feel like they are in an opportunity where they can be rehabilitated and not graduate to committing serious felony offenses that may get them, you know, caught up in the prison system for life. But in order to do that, they need a lot more than just the traditional courtroom atmosphere.
So explain what you give them.
And so during the program, they do things like life skills classes. We give them job training. They do community service. They will complete often not just their GED, but get high school equivalency certificates. And we do things like giving them classes on how to be more financially secure in a sense of understanding what you need to make, how to pay your bills, all these different things that they need in order to set themselves up when they do get that job or when they can get into college to go get their associates or bachelor's. They need resources that can teach them how to be productive members of society.
And David, how do you work with Sherry Boston? What do you do?
What I do is I go in there and I sit with the people who are in the program one-on-one and I talk to them. And what I try to do is I try to relate to them the actual process and why it's so important. Because the reason I believe it's important, and I'm grateful for people like Sherry, because progressive thinkers like that can change the thinking of the people growing up in those situations. When I was growing up in that situation, I thought that the government was the bad guy. I always used to think, hey, look, I can't trust them. They have a badge, they have a gun, they have a robe, they want to put me in jail. And that's not really the truth. The truth is that there are good folks out there in the system that have these diversion programs like Miss Boston, and they're doing anything that they can to help put good people back into the community. And so what I do is I meet with them and I say, look, on a day-to-day basis, we may be on the opposite sides of the tribunal, but today, for people like you that we believe that we can put back into the community, and instead of having you have a record, we want you to have a resume, we are doing whatever we can to help you. So I talk to these kids and I do whatever I can to get to know them on a personal level and just speak to them about what they need to do and give them coaching. Just like Ms. Boston was saying, we have financial workshops, we have resume writing, we have community service to teach them how to go out there and work for things. And that's what I've been doing. And it's been a blessing because it feels that we are actually making a difference with these kids.
Is there an example you can tell us of specific?
Just recently, as of last Friday, I met a young man, and I don't want to give his name, but I'm very proud of him because he told me he reflects on his issues, and his issues are that he is poor, and he is just so mad about the fact that he doesn't have enough, and that's why he acts out. And he said that all he wants to do is be an artist one day, not an artist as in a rapper. He wants to actually draw. He wants to be an artist. And so he said that he doesn't know where to start, and we talked about the GED program, and he promised me that he would do the GED. I told him that we would work Mrs. Boston's program and my program. We would sponsor the GED so that we can help this kid. And I mean, he lit up. He lit up that someone would listen to his story, that someone actually cared, and that somebody wanted to put resources behind his aspirations. And that was just this Friday, and that's just the most recent one. But there are so many of them. I mean, there's 30, 40 people per class. Mm.
David, you've displayed such grit, industry, and perseverance in your young life. You must be one heck of a defense attorney.
I've never been one to pound my chest, I enjoy what I do. I'm extremely passionate about what I do. I feel like I went through the system enough times when I was younger that I kind of had some understanding of how things happen in a courtroom. And because of that experience, I feel like my passion has only increased, and I just love what I do.
One of the most painful things for you was watching as your brother and two sisters started going down a similar path, emulating you, in where they were so good, you were also good, and then you started going off, and so they started going off. So if you would give us an update now about where your parents, your sisters, and your brother.
Sure. My whole thinking was always, if they follow me while I'm doing bad, will they follow me while I'm doing good? And I don't take any credit for the success that my siblings have had, because they're phenomenal humans and I love them to death. But just to give you an update on where they're at, the youngest one recently graduated from Florida State University, and she is a behavior analyst for autistic children. She's living in San Diego. Giselle, the second youngest, she is a human resources director for a huge company that does solar paneling in San Diego. They live together. Not live together, but they live in the same community. And my brother has an online store, a bookstore, and he also works, and he is of the best character. He is the person I always go to whenever I need to have a conversation about what things are happening in my life. And he is just such a good person. No one ever got arrested again. No one ever had any troubles, and just everything turned around. And I'm so proud of them. My folks are still living in North Miami Beach, which I'm doing whatever I can to try to get them maybe to move to San Diego or to Atlanta. We're working on those things now.
David, and also just to tie things up, how about your friend Mr. Torres, who was convicted? Mm-hmm. Are you still in touch?
I do. I speak with him all the time. We write to each other once a month, or we speak on the phone. And I'm inspired by him because he has done everything he can to position himself to not become a recidivist when he gets out. He has educated himself in there as much as he could. His writing skills, you could see that they developed, and I would always write him because of that. And he's someone that I kind of look up to because it could have been me. And he has taken this very well, and now he's planning on getting out and getting the barbershop that we always talked about that he would have whenever he's able to do it legally.
So you're still with us, Ms. Boston?
Yes.
Yeah, so what are the two of you have coming up? I mean, what are plans for working together, more plans for working together? Do you have things that are going to be developed?
Absolutely. Well, David started volunteering with us earlier this year, and he has made a tremendous impact on our goal participants. We were looking for that sort of last leg of our stool in our program, which was finding someone that our participants could really relate to and feel like they wanted to motivate themselves to do whatever they wanted. And David has been a tremendous, tremendous part of that, doing that one thing that we just simply couldn't do. And so we look forward to that continuing relationship and David continuing to be a mentor to the kids in our program, because that's super important. Also, David has graciously earmarked $1,500 from his nonprofit to help pay for the GEDs that our participants can't afford. Mm. This program is completely funded by grant money and things that we can scrape up when it comes to paying for these services. I mean, the vast majority of these participants have zero funds, and we are giving them classes and counseling that would cost most people in the thousands of dollars. So to have an organization like his nonprofit willing to help support our program, I am genuinely thankful for.
David, it sounds like a movie to me.
funny you should mention that.
Yeah, if it's in God's plan, it'll all work out. I believe I've recently signed what's called a shopping agreement with the Tyler Perry Studios, and so we're in the process of finding a writer to put it into a movie type format. And then I guess a budget, and then proposed cast. So over the next 12 to 24 months, you know, hopefully things will come together and we'll be able to do that, because the book has gained a lot of momentum. It was number one new release under biographies, and people are telling me they're reading it in one day. And so hopefully that movie will eventually be out.
Who do you want to play you?
You know, I'm not too sure about that. I just hope that I get a cameo.
I hope so, too. Well, it's been great to talk to you. Do you want to give a shout out to your folks?
I just want to tell them that, you know, I'm grateful for everything that they did for me. And I'm going to keep fighting to continue to be the man that they raised me to be. And I'm just so grateful for everything that they did for me. I love them so much.
Mm. Bye.
Oh, David Windicher, he is a criminal defense attorney. He's licensed to practice in both Georgia and Florida. Before we finish saying goodbye to you, let me just say thank you to Sherry Boston. She is the DeKalb County Solicitor General in Decatur, Georgia. Thank you so much for joining us, Ms. Boston.
Thank you for having me.
And all the best to you. And David is currently the managing partner at the Windicher Law Firm. It's Windecher. And normally our online producer, Paul Leary, would have all these links up, but he's out today, but he'll get them up, David.
As soon as possible.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure. We really appreciate you.
Thank you.
Technical direction by online producer Michael Stock. Perhaps you know someone who'd like to hear this program. We have free audio archives and downloads of this and other programs at our website, WLRN.org. Our producer is Richard Ives. And more information, including links and photos, at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow's Topical Currents is another At Your Service edition. It's our monthly pet health and welfare advice program. It's At Your Service.